what defines many of the countries of sub-Saharan Africa is this regular exposure to external terms of trade shocks, where that's the day-to-day of macroeconomic management.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Global macroeconomic shocks can pull the rug out from under the best policymakers. And since 2020, governments everywhere have had to grapple with the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. And then, of course, it's complicated by other factors, including the war in Ukraine. And these challenges have been particularly acute in Africa. Chris Adam of the Department of International Development at the University of Oxford has seen the impacts of these shocks at first hand and has also advised some of the people who have been making policy in Africa to mitigate their effects. He joins me now. Chris, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hello, Tim. Thank you for inviting me.
In Europe, we think of COVID, other shocks like the war in Ukraine, a sort of once in a generation economic events. Is the same true about how they're considered in Africa?
Yes and no. And let me explain. These two events, and we might just bundle them together as a sort of single crisis episode, did have huge impacts in sub-Saharan Africa. They were profoundly disruptive, both in retrospect and in anticipation. And in that sense, they were once in a generation types of shocks. And what marked them out in particular was their global nature. The other thing that made it a particularly acute crisis was that the timing for many countries in sub-Saharan Africa couldn't be worse. But another way of looking at this challenge is to recognize that for African countries in particular, certainly compared to those in Europe or other advanced economies, these countries have been disproportionately exposed to large economic shocks, be they from dramatic collapses in commodity prices or sudden stops in foreign capital to internal conflict or cross-border conflict, other forms of market disruption. The macroeconomic management challenges of external shocks is the day-to-day bread and butter of policymakers in sub-Saharan Africa. So in that sense, COVID was just another crisis in a long sequence. But I think what marked it out is that especially with COVID, that the shock hit all countries at the same time and obviously hit globally, but even so had many of the elements of the previous shocks that the countries have been exposed to. So I think the simple answer is, yes, these are really important shocks and we need to spend a lot of time thinking about their nature and the lessons we learn from the way in which countries responded to these shocks. But the macroeconomic management of shocks is one of the defining features of day-to-day life for policymakers in sub-Saharan Africa.
Those of us lucky enough to live in high-income economies when COVID hit watched as our ministers of finance reached for the policy levers to pull. They were extraordinary levers, but they were there. Are the policy constraints in Africa much tighter than that?
Well, absolutely. And you're completely correct in that what we saw amongst the advanced economies was a really remarkable policy response to admittedly a remarkable shock. And I think the big difference is a question of kind of scale diversification and technology in the private sector. And then from a macro perspective, you can think of it in terms of the size of public sector balance sheets, those of governments and central banks. And that's going to determine the capacity for policy response. When you look at the response to the advanced economies, for example, we heard a lot of the phrase that originally came from Mario Draghi in the context of the Eurozone crisis, that governments would do whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes.
Throughout COVID, indeed, advanced economies could and did do whatever it takes. So just to put this in context, if you look at the first year and a half or so of from the outbreak of COVID in, let's say, March 2020, the G20 countries spent something around about $10 trillion, roughly 10% of global GDP, on fiscal measures, on providing guarantees, various forms of monetary support. And this was an environment where governments and central banks could expand their balance sheet. The Bank of England, for example, in the decade up to the early 2000s, its balance sheet was around about 7, 8, maybe 10% of UK GDP. Global financial crisis saw that expand with QE and other forms of intervention. But the Bank of England added another 10% of GDP to its balance sheet. The purchase of securities, the pumping money in, the support of the domestic economy. So on a monetary balance sheet perspective, those instruments were available. The other point about advanced economies is that well-established, deep fiscal systems are relatively well attuned to responding, making household transfers, transfers to firms. Essentially, you can run the tax system in reverse for a short period of time where you're giving tax credits, you're providing furlough payments to firms, you're providing transfers to households. And on both of these dimensions, this really wasn't an option for many sub-Saharan African countries.
Mm-hmm.
From a central banking perspective, there are limited foreign exchange reserves. There aren't swap lines with the Fed. The costs and the risks of just rapid expansion of the domestic currency balance sheet were very high. There's also relatively limited fiscal space at the beginning of 2020 in many countries. From a macro perspective, those balance sheets are just much narrower and less able to expand substantially and rapidly without causing adverse problems for exchange rates, for inflation, and so forth. And at the same time, on the fiscal side of things, fiscal systems are just not as deeply embedded. Their reach is not as far into the economy. If you think of highly informal economies, the difficulty of taxing agriculture, and so the ability of the fiscal system to run in reverse and reach out and provide support at the household and the firm level, it's not that it was absent, it was just not quite as effective.
And given these constraints, how can an economist like yourself be useful in these circumstances? I would guess offering policy advice is a very different task.
I think that's right. To the extent that the economics profession deserves any credit, I think it's probably those policy economists, those working closely with governments and international agencies,
mm-hmm.
rather than academia, that really deserve any credit that's out there. The performance of the profession in that sense and the key economic policy advice institutions around the world was generally good through COVID in the following senses. First, I think the tenor of macroeconomic advice at the domestic level and the international level was pretty good. The effective fiscal monetary exchange rate coordination that is required, in other words, what to do when a crisis like that hits, was transmitted clearly and implemented pretty effectively. And if I can say that about sub-Saharan Africa, since the mid-1990s, we've witnessed a really profound and deep reforms in the capacity and articulation of economic policy advice across the continent. It's unrecognizable. And this event was when those new frameworks were put to the test. That was handled really rather successfully. There was quite a rapid coordination around a view of what a well-informed diagnosis of the crisis was,
mm-hmm.
of the challenges, and hence a pretty well-informed prognosis of the policy response. In a circumstance where there was broad agreement that this was a temporary, deep economic shock, and one that, if poorly managed, could turn those temporary crisis problems into medium-term extended problems. But I don't want to forget about the very solid, informed microeconomic work that others in the economics profession did.
Yes.
I'm thinking, for example, of the work on mechanism design that, say, Michael Kramer and colleagues worked on around vaccine supply, the work that people did on the design and rollout of social assistance programs, thinking about detailed work on specific tax reforms. I think this has all contributed to a generally pretty good response by the economics profession here. But let me go back to the macro for just a second and make two points. This was a crisis where I always sort of think of it using the following mantra, that finance if you can, adjust if you must. So in circumstances where economies or societies are faced with these shocks that are perceived to be temporary, and COVID, there was a lot of uncertainty, but it was basically a temporary shock.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent can you finance your way through that shock without creating unsustainable problems for the future? And financing allows for the least amount of disruption. But there comes a point where financing must be accompanied by adjustment, hard adjustments on various macro policy choices. And if you must adjust, then you clearly want to do so in a way that one does the least damage to the recovery post-shock, i.e. don't cannibalize public investment in growth-enhancing infrastructure and human capital post-shock, and secondly, be sensitive to distributional considerations and consequences of macro policies. And I was lucky enough to do some work with the Bank of International Settlements in 2021 and 22, where we looked at policy responses in sub-Saharan Africa. And generally, the scorecard was good. The coordination between the fiscal authorities and the central bank was good. The speed with which governments were able to respond on fiscal dimensions, however constrained, was good. And while there were clearly problems and challenges, I think the overall sense was that the combination of the last 25 years of investment in good macroeconomic policy across sub-Saharan Africa, combined with a broadly conducive global environment of coordination and information exchange, meant that the macro management of the COVID shock was actually, in its own way, a success. On the scorecard, I would say it's a very strong B+, A- in terms of the macroeconomic response and marking our own scorecard for economists.
So now we have a little bit of perspective. We can maybe tell the story of the COVID macro shock. So let's go back to the beginning of 2020 and what the state of growth and debt was in sub-Saharan Africa. How would you characterize that?
I think this is really important for understanding the dynamics of this shock and its legacy. Yes. The timing could not have been worse. To understand where the continent or many countries in the continent were on the eve of the outbreak of COVID, you need to go back probably a decade or so. What we had from more or less post the global financial crisis in 2008 was a period of really rapid growth, and rapid growth based on very high external demand, principally from China, for the kind of commodities and inputs into powering the Chinese growth episode that occurred certainly during the 2010s. Many countries in sub-Saharan Africa find themselves able to access private capital markets and moved rapidly into contracting, at the time, quite attractive Eurobond finance, private market finance, to complement capital inflows from China, from other new official creditors, as well as from the traditional IMF, World Bank, regional development banks. By 2015-16, commodity prices were declining quite dramatically. We talk about the end of the commodity super cycle around about 2014 and 2015. Mm-hmm. Obviously, growth in China was cooling. The key point here is that many governments were a bit slow to respond. While that underlying growth was slowing down, the underlying productivity growth was actually much more modest than it appeared during the period of high commodity prices. The necessary accompanying fiscal adjustment to bring macro balance back in line with the new reality of lower growth and higher costs of borrowing didn't occur particularly quickly. By the end of 2019, in terms of the arithmetic of debt, all the indicators were pointing in the wrong direction. So the key things that are going to make debt sustainable are high levels of growth, and growth was softening, strong fiscal positions, and the fiscal position was definitely weakening across many countries, low costs of capital, in reality, because of the risk premium and the risk appetite declining amongst private investors, those costs of capital were increasing. On the outbreak of COVID, there were a significant number of countries in high risk of debt distress or in debt distress. And so what that meant, very simply, was that as soon as the COVID outbreak became apparent and the spillover from the global economy started to hit the economies of Africa, we were in a world where doing whatever it takes was highly constrained by very limited fiscal space.
And then in the early weeks of COVID, was it felt mostly in Africa as a health shock or an economic shock?
Oh, it was very much an economic shock. There was clearly a lot of concern articulated by the WHO and others about the direct health risks of COVID. And would it have the same transmission dynamics as we saw in highly urbanized Europe? And it turned out that the transmission and the severity from a pure health perspective of COVID in sub-Saharan Africa was much weaker. It's not that it was non-existent and the many, many people succumbed to COVID, not least because much of the intensive care treatment that people in advanced economies could access was not available. Mm. But it was fundamentally an economic shock, not a direct public health shock. And the way I think about the way this unfolded is in terms of essentially three elements to that shock. The first was common around the world with the direct supply side effects of a lockdown. So lockdown meant less output, essentially. Mm-hmm. And because of a lower level of technology and internet access, there was less ability to substitute working from home and online working for office work that we experienced in advanced economies. The second thing was the spillover effects of lockdown elsewhere. Take, for example, Kenya or South Africa or Mauritius and the Seychelles. These economies that had developed a growth strategy based around international tourism, at a stroke, that was gone. One of the biggest export earners in these economies was just shut down completely. So closure of key sectors was a second element. And just generally, the higher cost of production, lower efficiency, higher cost of production just meant that the aggregate supply side of the economy weakened. But a key feature for African economies was the demand side spillover, the consequences of the global recession. And what that meant was through three channels, you had a sharp contraction of aggregate demand. Commodity prices fell around the world, certainly in the early parts of the COVID shock. There was a sudden stop of capital inflows. So FDI more or less dried up, and that there was, as ever, when you have global crises, a flight to security. So capital moved back to the US to dollar-denominated assets. And the third element was there was a serious concern that remittance income from the advanced economies would decline sharply. But this turned out to be more resilient, probably because of furlough and support systems that were put in place by many advanced economies. So remittance revenues were more resilient than we thought. But taken together, there was just a very sharp contraction in the capacity to import. Consumer goods, medicines, etc., were harder to get. But more importantly, there was a big decline in capital goods imports. At the time, there was a lot of uncertainty about whether there was a second wave risk around the corner, and that led to further falls in investment and kind of precautionary behavior.
I recall at the time, everyone was thinking about uncertainty in every country. Every policy economist was worried that they were making policy effectively in the dark. There was so much that they didn't know. You must have had some conversations with policymakers in sub-Saharan Africa at the time. Were they feeling the same way?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There was a strong sense both nationally and internationally of this second wave risk concern that we're basically going to throw everything at this problem now, by which we mean sort of in the first 6-9 months. What are we going to do if, having done that, the global society is hit by a second wave? What do we do when essentially the fiscal space has been completely exhausted? But what was interesting was a sense that we've got to take a gamble on this. A lot of the policy response was front-loaded. And even though there was a discussion about, are we just, what was the term they used, flattening the sombrero, sort of the incidence curve has been flattened but pushed off into the future, there was still a view that that was the optimal response, especially, and again, if we think about back to sort of the second, third quarter of 2020, there was uncertainty about the timing of the vaccine, but there was also enormous confidence that the vaccine would be developed. The uncertainty, was it going to be in 6 months or a year? The vaccine development process was certainly at the front end of expectations. We can maybe in another occasion talk about all the problems associated with the rollout of vaccine, but the combination that vaccines were made available and made available rapidly in advanced economies, and COVID was lower in many parts of the global south, meant that that gamble paid off in the end. But it was, as you say, it was decision-making under uncertainty.
I had forgotten the phrase flattening the sombrero, Chris. Thank you for reminding me about that.
Yeah.
Were the policy choices made by African policymakers, were they optimal?
Optimal is always a dangerous word, but were they were they sensible given the circumstances? I think they were generally the right policies, broadly sensibly implemented. The balance, and again, I'm speaking as a macroeconomist, the balance in terms of monetary, fiscal policy, financing, and debt were broadly very sensible, I think. They were well coordinated. There was a reasonable level of, I don't know, call it forbearance in the financial sector, that central banks relaxed their regulatory regimes a little bit, recognizing that banks had a buildup of non-performing loans because of lockdown effects and so forth. I think they moved to a sensible degree there. So I think the domestic policy responses across a very large number of countries in sub-Saharan Africa were maybe not optimal, but pretty sensible, pretty solid. And the international community, I think, is also an interesting story here.
Yes.
At some level, the international response, at least vis-a-vis low-income countries, was pretty good. If we take some of the key institutions, the IMF probably would look back and say, yes, we had a pretty good crisis. The fund moved quickly. It expanded its balance sheet really quite substantially, provided a lot of short-term liquidity support to low-income countries, and in that sense, lived up to the IMF's fundamental objective, which is to make its own resources temporarily available to its members to support adjustment without doing excess damage, either domestically or internationally. We also saw at the same time the debt service standstill initiative from the G20, which eased some of the financing constraints. We saw the start of improved debt resolution mechanisms through the G20 common framework. Again, far from working effectively even yet, but these initiatives were rather good. There is a view that comes out from the Center for Global Development and others that the World Bank and the regional development banks were a bit slow. They didn't use their balance sheets quite as much. But generally speaking, I think the short-run response was favorable. I think the really interesting thing is the extent to which that response was sustained and how we're managing the legacies of those short-term responses.
We're now four and a half years on. What have been the scarring effects of COVID and the responses to it?
The growth recovery on the global economy and in sub-Saharan Africa has been much more anemic than was hoped for. So the best case scenario was a kind of a steep V crisis. There was a sharp decline and a pretty rapid recovery. That recovery has been slow. If you look at the sequence of projections from 2020 onwards in the World Economic Outlook or other agencies, it's one of these sort of classic, it's like a hedgehog upside down, that each time you put a new projection, it's on a slower converging path than before. That reflects two or three issues. One is at a global level, with a few exceptions. The United States is the obvious exception, but China and Europe have recovered much more slowly. The UK is another classic example that the response in terms of productivity growth and broader economic growth has been much slower than anticipated. That lower global growth spills over into sub-Saharan Africa. Per capita growth rates are still much lower than they were pre-COVID. Roughly speaking, on a per capita basis, 1.5 to 2.5% as opposed to 3, 4, 4.5%. And that's a very big gap. What's the reason? One, global growth is lower. A second issue is this sort of the debt hangover, I think, is really quite severe. So the legacy of debt and debt distress remains a heavy burden. The debt service suspension initiative was a temporary measure. The common framework is still struggling. And a lot of countries are still operating in a world where the debt service burden is crowding out public expenditure on critical investments. The idea that what you want to do is to respond in a way that doesn't essentially cannibalize future growth recoveries has not materialized as well as we had hoped at the time. So public investment is stagnant, private investment is still pretty low. And then the other bit that some of my more recent work was focused on is the consequences on human capital of COVID. there are two effects at work here. At the time, there was quite a sharp diversion of spending in the health sector towards preventative measures against COVID, but away from many of the chronic health challenges facing many countries in sub-Saharan Africa. So the TB and malaria infection rates and mortality rates have risen. Mm-hmm. Chronic conditions, diabetes, coronary heart problems have worsened. And that has a direct burden on human capital and productivity. But the other area is the loss of learning effects. What were the consequences of these big lockdowns of education, primary, secondary, and tertiary? And I have a paper with some colleagues from the IMF where we look at this loss of learning effect, inspired by some excellent work by economists working in education. One piece in particular, Lant Pritchett, did some work looking at the long-term consequences of a very specific lockdown effect. It was related to the 2015 earthquake in northern Pakistan, and they followed the learning outcomes of children who were out of school for only, I think, 3 months at that stage because buildings had been destroyed and so forth, mm-hmm. and traced that through a decade-long period, and were able to measure the direct effects on the productivity of these school graduates as they enter the labor market.
Gosh.
I think this is a really potentially serious long-run cost of scarring, exactly that. It's a human capital scarring effect. The World Bank has estimated that real GDP on a level basis could be 4 to 5% lower on a permanent basis as a result of this shock. The scarring on the loss of human capital is probably a very serious area. The failure to really get on top of the debt overhang is serious. Against the background of a loss of appetite for overseas development assistance, the principal donors are less generous than they used to be. Domestic pressures have seen the cutback in aid budgets in many countries. At a moment when new money, new concessional finance, is absolutely central to successful resolution of some of these debt crises, that is a serious legacy of the crisis.
As any policymaker will know, crises don't just come in ones. Since the end of the large part of the COVID shock, we have seen, certainly in the global north, the crisis around the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the effect that that has had globally. How has that been felt in sub-Saharan Africa?
What you say is absolutely central to the way we should think about macroeconomics and the challenges. Unfortunately, our textbooks talk about shocks in the singular. The reality is compounded shocks, multiple shocks. The buzzword at the moment is polycrises. When we look at the way in which the global economy was recovering from COVID and thinking about it from the perspective of the challenges faced by the lower income countries of sub-Saharan Africa, Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the global economic consequences of that is a really important element of that multiple and repeating crises. But I would put it in with two other elements that are relevant. One is obviously the global economy was taken by surprise by the sharp uptick in global inflation because of recovery and demand and supply chain shortages and so forth. And the monetary policy response to that, led by the US but elsewhere, was a sharp increase in interest rates. And that itself is a big shock to indebted countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And then very close beside that, you have the effect of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which had a massive impact on three critical traded global commodities. Oil prices spiked in the short run. Global food prices spiked, particularly for the principal exports from Ukraine, so wheat prices, but also fertilizer. So there's three key prices. At the time, there was a lot of work from IFPRI and others saying, oh, this is a global adverse price shock. This is going to damage countries in sub-Saharan Africa. Well, yes and no. It clearly is highly damaging these increases in commodity prices, particularly the food price shock, to the net consumers of food. So in countries with a food deficit where they're importing food, then that demands responses from governments. Mm-hmm. But if you're a net food exporter, hey, that's a good thing. Global prices have increased, market opportunities have improved. There are clearly winners there. Fuel price shocks and fertilizer shocks are just costs of import, cost of production shocks. and they have been damaging, certainly over the short to medium term. Global commodity prices have come back down to not their long run mean, but they've definitely come back off the peak that we saw in 2022. So the spillover effects from Russia's invasion of Ukraine have been much more classically temporary in that sense. So I think it's hard to make general statements about the specifics of the Ukraine crisis, as we did about the COVID crisis, the economic crisis. I think the interesting thing about Russia's invasion of Ukraine is that it's creating a lot of internal political tension around alignment, political alignment across sub-Saharan Africa, with different countries seeing their interests lying rather differentially between supporting traditional Western powers and support for Russia, South Africa being a classic example of that. Without being trite about this, the Ukraine price shock is almost like business as usual for sub-Saharan Africa. What defines many of the countries of sub-Saharan Africa is this regular exposure to external terms of trade shocks, where that's the day-to-day of macroeconomic management.
This series of shocks been going on for a decade and a half. Is there an argument that we should look internally at the economies of sub-Saharan Africa, where domestic reform might make them more resilient to shocks?
Absolutely. I think resilience is the key word here. And I suppose I would qualify what you said, not that we should look at domestic reform. I think we should look at continued domestic reform. I think you've got to be aware of the really profound changes that have occurred over the last 25, 30 years or so in many countries. The key areas that I suspect would come at no great surprise is when faced with these kind of real shocks, the key instruments are fiscal instruments. And so developing more effective fiscal buffers is the critical part of a macro reform program, as far as I would see it. The focus still remains on the question of domestic revenue mobilization. The ability to efficiently and in a relatively undistorted way extract revenue from the private sector by the state and put it to good use is absolutely central. It still is the case that if you look at obviously advanced economies, but also the more resilient, flexible economies of East Asia, they are operating at levels of revenue to GDP, domestic revenue mobilization, in the mid to high 30% range. And that gives the state more capacity to pull these levers to develop the responsiveness that characterized many of the advanced economies and many of the bigger emerging market countries during COVID. If you look at sub-Saharan Africa, those numbers are not 35 to 40%. They're at best 15 to 20%. And that low level of domestic revenue mobilization is the biggest challenge. But it's not simply a matter of just jacking up tax rates. As we saw in the recent riots in Kenya, the question is not about the rate of taxation. Arguably, at the margin, tax rates are way too high. The problem is that the tax base. And it's the challenge of taxing economies that are relatively undiversified, still overwhelmingly based on primary production, problems of taxing informal economies, agriculture, effective and efficient taxation of the service sector. These are the big challenges, I think, in terms of a micro-macro agenda, improving revenue mobilization. That's how you build fiscal buffers. Allied with that, I think, is a more international perspective on reform, and that is thinking a lot harder about risk sharing in international finance. Mm-hmm. We know that Econ 101 would tell you that a debt contract is probably the worst contract between a big, rich lender and a poor, undiversified, risk-averse borrower.
Right.
Because debt just shifts all the risk to the debtor. And we are beginning to see some important progress in this area about risk sharing in international finance, about debt becoming increasingly state contingent, would be the word, linking debt instruments to natural disasters and that kind of thing. I think the combination of further work on risk and risk sharing, and it sounds very corny, but more generosity in the ODA front for macro stabilization seems to me to be the key elements of reform at the international level that still need to be pushed hard. if COVID told us anything and climate change is telling us anything, is that the global spillovers from local shocks are large. The idea that these are shocks that occur in sub-Saharan Africa and the consequences remain in sub-Saharan Africa is not a tenable position. The interconnectedness of the world means that addressing the effective management of this forms of volatility, be they pandemics, climate-related shocks, it's a global public bad that requires global public action to address.
One thing we know for sure, Chris, is that we have not seen the last global macroeconomic shock. It might not even be the last global shock this year. Are there still gaps in our knowledge about how to cope with these shocks that academic research can fill in?
I suppose inevitably there are gaps. At one level, I think our basic kind of macroeconomic understanding is pretty good. The burden from a research perspective is shifting towards understanding the political economy dynamics of managing shocks. One thing about balance sheets and budget constraints is that they always hold everywhere and always. There's something rather simple about, for example, the arithmetic of debt. It's a simple manipulation of identities, we call it in macroeconomics. But the challenge is not getting better at manipulating the identities. It's thinking about the political economy of revenue mobilization. And although this is not directly related to COVID, but the Kenyan story is a great example of how should we think about the political economy process of raising that mobilization rate at a time when you've got competitive politics, interest groups, and distributional effects that are really profound. I see maybe two or three research agendas, the political economy of that process of transformation and reform being one of them. I think there is a technical issue of a research area around the global finance issue, mobilizing finance, understanding risk and the properties of risk-sharing instruments more effectively in the context of climate change. And I see those as the two big agendas at the moment. I don't want to be complacent about the macroeconomics, but in a sense, there are approaches to macroeconomics that we might want to focus on a little bit more. We may be still be a little bit too beholden to these simple equilibrium models, when in fact the world is characterized by a lot of non-linearity and multiple equilibria and the like. But I think the really interesting agenda here is probably the political economy agenda.
Chris, we have many things to discuss, but not the time to discuss them. Will you come back later?
Oh, I'd be delighted to. There are lots of things that this conversation has stimulated in my mind, and it would be very nice to have an opportunity to talk about them.
I look forward to it. But until then, Chris Adam, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Tim. It's been an enjoyable conversation. Thank you.
If you want to read more of Chris's research on the topics we've been discussing today, there are three references. First one, Buffy, Adam, Zana and Kapodar, Loss of Learning and Post-COVID Recovery in Low-Income Countries. That was in the Journal of Macroeconomics 75, published 2023. Also, Adam, Albarora and Pierres, COVID-19 and the Monetary Fiscal Policy Nexus in Africa. That was Bank of International Settlements, Working Paper 121 from 2022. And finally, Adam, Henstridge and Lee, After the Lockdown, Macroeconomic Adjustment to the COVID-19 Pandemic in Sub-Saharan Africa. That was published in the Oxford Review of Economic Policy 36, that was in 2020. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts, all our past episodes, as always, or also at voxdev.org.